This is the Play to Win podcast from Aconite Books with me, James Wallace. This first series of the podcast accompanies my new book, Everybody Wins, Four Decades of the Greatest Board Games Ever Made, out now in the UK and coming to the US and Canada in spring 2023. Hello, and welcome to Everybody Wins, the podcast that is the Dr. Watson to the Sherlock Holmes that is Everybody Wins, Four Decades of the Greatest Board Games Ever Made, by me, James Wallace. In the last episode, we looked at the birth of what we think of now as Eurogame design. By the time we hit the mid-90s, really interesting things are happening in Germany, heralded by Klaus Teuber's last and greatest Spiel des Jahres winner, Settlers of Catan, ushering in a new golden age of games that produce, among others, El Grande, Ticket to Ride, Carcassonne, and other massive notable titles. All of this is covered in some depth in the book. What we don't cover, because none of them won the Spiel des Jahres, is what was happening on the other side of the Atlantic, where there were no less seismic changes going on. Things, events, publications that would change the face of the games industry as we know it, with echoes and rumbles that continue to this day. For this third episode, I'm joined by two people who were integral to the industry, the games industry, particularly in America, but globally, more than that, in the mid-90s to the early 2000s, Peter Atkinson and John Kovalik. Gentlemen, could you introduce yourselves, please?
Okay. I've just never been described as integral before, so I'm going to be adding that to the resume now. I'm John Kovalik. I do a comic strip ostensibly about gamers called Dork Tower, which is approaching its 30th anniversary, believe it or not. And I've also become a game designer and a game illustrator. I've worked on games like such as Apples to Apples, Munchkin, Shea Geek, Cash and Guns, and really many, many, many more. Over 100, including all of the supplements and such like. And so I've been a professional in this crazy business for about 25 years now.
Wow. And Peter?
I'm Peter Atkinson. I was the co-founder of Wizards of the Coast back in 1990 and was the CEO for 10 years through the 90s. While I was there, we published Magic the Gathering. We acquired TSR, came out with Dungeons and Dragons 3rd Edition, and we brought Pokemon cards from Japan to America and then pretty much the rest of the world. After I sold the company, I bought back Gen Con from Hasbro, the company I sold WotC to, and have owned Gen Con ever since. I love Gen Con. It's fantastic. Everybody in the gaming industry is my customer. I like that. I like that attitude that it puts on me. And my kind of a side business slash hobby slash hustle is I've been doing a lot of Twitch and YouTube programming lately, turning role-playing games into movies.
Wow. Those are both incredible CVs. John, if we can start with you. Dork Tower is ostensibly the stories of a bunch of gamers in the Midwest of America. I think what it really is, looking back at it from where we are now, is a kind of almost a cultural commentary on gamer culture, geek culture, and how it's risen and changed over the last, you say, almost 30 years. When did it actually start?
1996 is, I believe, I was at Gen Con. And by the way, Peter, wouldn't it have just been easier not to have sold Gen Con?
Yeah. I had to wait for them to realize they didn't want it so I could get a good price.
Okay. Dork Tower actually came about at Gen Con. I think it was 1996.
I love it when a story starts off like this. We were at Gen Con and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. Okay. Great. Good story.
Yes. All the best stories have got Gen Con in them. At least most of my favorite ones. And so, yes, I was at Gen Con 1996. I'd been getting back into board gaming and role playing. I had sort of dropped out a little bit in the late 1980s, mid to late 1980s, when I decided I actually needed a college degree. But then I started getting back, and I had been drawing some single panel cartoons for Shadus, and had been contributing to the John Tynes Unspeakable Oath zine. And one of the editors at Shadus asked me if I would consider doing a comic strip for them. And I'd been a cartoonist professionally since about 1988 with a syndicated comic strip called Wildlife. And I just started, you know, a comic strip about gamers was extremely appealing to me for a number of reasons, not least of which was every game I bought would then become tax deductible, business expense. So that's sort of...
I have to say that has kept me going through some of the bad years of this. It's the fact that I can write off my entire hobby as a business expense.
Exactly.
Well, you need to have a game store too, so that you can write it off and get it at a discount.
That is thinking. That is the kind of thinking that makes you CEO of Gen Con, ladies and gentlemen. So anyway, by the time I walked from the Shadus booth back to the exit, I had this germ of an idea about three gamers. I briefly thought about just porting over my characters from the strip Wildlife. And in the end, only Carson really came over, Carson the Muskrat from the old strip, even though the other characters have made guest appearances. And yeah, very quickly, I had, you know, designed three characters based on three, the names came from three friends of ours, Matt, Ken, and Igor. And I just started with basic shapes. You know, I hadn't really designed new characters for the longest time. And so I did what I tell every high school class I talk to do, which is just start out with basic shapes. So Matt's head was basically a triangle. Igor's head is basically a square. And Ken's head was basically the circle. And the very first strip, I'm not sure if it was published. I'd have to look this back up in late 96 or early 97. But it was about collectible card games, which was the big thing back in the day. And yeah, it's just the strip evolved along with gaming culture. I certainly could not really do a strip anymore about mundanes being frightened by gamers. Those days are past. One of the more well-known lines from the strip is, "Hey, Marcia, come see the Satanist." And
I was about to talk about it, because that was literally the third strip you did, of Ken trying to buy some gaming books at a regular bookstore, and the clerk just being terrified, yes, essentially not getting it at all. And then, 15 years later, I think, you go back, you reintroduce this unnamed character and the off-screen, yes, Marcia. And Ken goes into a different bookstore, encounters the same clerk, asks pretty much the same question. And suddenly, she's a full-on geek. She talks just completely. She's got the lingo. She's into games. She's got a massive crush on Will Wheaton. Let's be honest. We all had a massive crush on Will Wheaton back then. And she's a cosplayer, and then again the same character has made another appearance very, very recently. But that for me sums up. I mean, it's outside the decade that we're supposed to be talking about, but the change in culture, and the spread of games culture is something that people just there's been an osmosis. It's just spread out. Even if you're not a gamer, you now understand games culture. The phrase "leveling up" is used extensively by the British government to describe something that they're not actually doing, but they claim to be doing. But that's a D&D term.
Yeah.
But James, don't you think that indeed, yes, this is the decade where this is happening? I mean, talking about mid-90s to mid-aughts, we're not quite at what I call the hockey stick inflection point where our types of games become totally mass market, but that it's really all the building blocks are happening during that decade. You know, MMOs are taking off and becoming a big thing. Video games are becoming better and better. And tabletop games are doing great, having a big resurgence, and role-playing games and board games. All the things are happening that will change the public's opinion of tabletop games are definitely in this decade.
Yeah. Yeah. And Peter, I think it's your fault.
I'm just going to pass the blame back to Richard Garfield on that one. Okay. If it wouldn't have been for Richard designing Magic the Gathering, Wizards would just be another long forgotten dead RPG company. I mean,
there were so many of them. Tell the story. Richard Garfield, who the designer of Magic the Gathering, that was not the game that he brought you.
That's true.
He brought you Robo Rally, I believe.
Yeah, he had something. He was an amateur game designer. He'd never been published. He had something like, I don't know, 76 games that he designed that were in his closet, maybe at various stages, and he brought this game, Robo Rally, which we would eventually publish, but that's when I first saw it, I was not in a position to publish it. It looked, we were just trying to get our hands around how to print on paper, and then you add boards and components and everything. It was pretty scary because all we'd done is role-playing it at the time. And so, I certainly contributed. I suggested that maybe a card game with science fiction or fantasy sort of themes, because I kind of had an idea that there's a lot of really cool art being made that's not making it to market, because especially color art in those days, there were very limited. We all knew in 1992, if you were a gamer, you had seen every piece of color fantasy art ever published, because there just weren't that many and you loved them. And we all knew who the artists were. I did say that, but the whole idea of a collectible cards, everybody has their own deck and there's thousands of cards and all stuff like that, that are sort of hallmarks of a trading card game. That's all Richard, so. I was just lucky enough to be in the room and honored enough that he said, invited me to publish it. So
given the current market value of a Black Lotus, a beta Black Lotus, it's hilarious to me that you published Magic first because it was less expensive.
It's crazy. I had I was once at an auction where a case of Arabian Nights was auctioned. Now, a case meaning not a display box, which had, 36 boosters or whatever. I'm not sure that's the right number. But anyway, like a case slot from Card of Monday, the original packaging had 10 display boxes of Arabian Nights in it, which was the first expansion for Magic the Gathering. And at the auction, this went for $96,000, which was like almost exactly the cost of the print run of the entire Arabian Nights set.
Did I ever tell you the story that my wife was not a gamer? When we were dating in the early 80s, 93, we started dating in 93, got married in 96. But my wife bought her wedding dress because, as a gamer, I did not want her to be scared of other gamers. And so I brought her into our gaming group. And Magic was starting to happen then. And so I would buy a Magic deck or boosters for myself, and I'd buy the same for her. And she got all the good cards. All the good cards. Like, she was like, Thicket Basilisk, is that good? Black Lotus, is that good? And I was like, Mountain, Plagrat, Mountain. Give me a swap, people. But anyway, when we actually got married, she sold her Black Lotus to pay for her wedding dress.
Wow. It is, for people who weren't there, it's hard to describe the impact that Magic had. I mean, I remember Gen Con 93, which I think is where it first went on retail sale.
That's right. Yep. That was the launch of Magic. Yep.
And I also had a card game out at that Gen Con. Once Upon a Time was launched there. And I was like, I hear Wizards have a thing. I'll go over and see how they're doing. And people were literally 6-7 deep around your booth, essentially fighting for any card that they could get. And it was like, I think they might do quite well out of this. and then actually, I don't know if I've told you this story. I can't remember who it was. I think she went on to edit Scry magazine. You would probably know the name. But she said, just grabbed me and said, have you played Magic? I'm like, no. So she grabbed a new deck, cracked it, shuffled it, dealt two hands. We played. Because of a lousy deal, I was not able to cast a single spell for the entire duration of the game. And I walked away going, well, it's a shame about Wizards of the Coast. I heard they did some nice stuff. This game's going to kill them.
Yeah.
And with that kind of industry insight, I then set up a role-playing company. But
I think that was, I think that might've been Joanne White.
I believe it. Yes. Yes, it was. So that is literally the only game of Magic I've ever played. But it took over the industry very, very quickly. It, I mean, not everyone was playing it, but every shop was stocking it in depth. And the main thing it did, it brought money into the industry in a deluge that it has never seen before or since. It changed the face of the games industry, first in America and very quickly in the rest of the world, by allowing retailers, which had been small and conservative, to take a punt on different styles of game, not least on other, initially other collectible card games.
Yeah.
I finally managed to sell off the last of my Star Trek game, which I bought a lot of that on speculative, for speculative purposes. And that was the last time I did that.
Yes, but I mean, people were buying it to speculate on it. It became something that, you know, it took the baseball card thing of collectible cards, and you know, those become valuable as well, and then added gameplay.
Well, the speculation aspect of Magic: The Gathering, that was the most dangerous time for us at WotC. It is sort of the end of 1994 going into 1995 when we had to do a big correction after an expansion called Fallen Empires, and which was the first time in our in the process where our ability to manufacture cards in terms of quantity caught up with demand. And then we discovered that a lot of the demand was not really people playing the game. It was people speculating on the game. And so there was a crash, and we had to navigate through that. And I'm really proud of that. I think it was like one thing that we did really well, where so many other parts of our success was good fortune, or maybe somebody else doing like Richard doing really well and coming up with a brilliant game, or good, the good fortune for us that, Ishihara brought Pokemon to us and said, hey, will you distribute it for us in the US? Or, the misfortune of TSR and basically, almost going bankrupt. These were all things that we got to capitalize on. But I like that time period of Magic being a speculative product and having to reposition it to focus on the gameplay, which led to our organized play initiative. That's a part where I personally am really proud of what we did at WotC in the 90s.
What happened essentially with the CCG, the Magic boom was followed very quickly by the CCG boom. And I know both of you have gone through this of creating or being part of the creation of a popular new game format that is picked up by other people who run with it, and you have no control over it because of the way that, the general perception of games mechanics is that they can't be protected intellectually. So many other people were doing collectible card games. John, you were part of the team that did Apples to Apples.
Yes.
Which was a big success in the late 90s, but has now, the Apples to Apples mechanic, as it's known, has just become part of the vocabulary of games designers. And there are many, many similar games out there.
Yes. Yes. Well, and that, honestly, part of going back to the collectible card games, it was Steve Jackson's Inuo CCG That was actually
in Illuminati New World Order.
Yes. It was actually that was actually my first professional credit as not just somebody doing games cartoons for the magazines and such. I'd been doing Murphy's Rules for Steve Jackson Games' Pyramid magazine, and I'd found out that they were going to be doing a collectible card game based on Illuminati. And just out of the blue, I decided to give Steve a call and just ask him, hey, I see you're doing this. Do you have any extra art that needs done? And Steve...
I just need to footnote this very, very briefly and say this is American Steve Jackson we're talking about, yes. Not British Steve yes. Jackson, the co-founder of Games Workshop, referenced extensively in episode one.
Yes. And yeah, Steve, the company was running a little bit late and had threw me 20 card illustrations to do. And Steve actually asked me on the phone, so do you know Watchmen? You know, you can do Watchmen style. And I was like, yeah, of course I can do Watchmen style. And immediately
Dave Gibbons highly rendered, very tight, classic yes. Comic school
and so,
style art.
Yes, as soon as we hung up the phone, I went to look up what the hell Watchmen was. but anyway, I did, you know, 20 cards for Illuminati. And that anyway led to another 20 for the expansion and some for the German edition. And that is actually how I was got on the radar of Out of the Box Publishing, which was a small, very small startup in Madison, Wisconsin. And I became an investor, very much the minority investor in the company, but the four people at Out of the Box were all financially invested in the company. And we had been set up to do a game called Bosworth, which was a chess variant. And we ended up...
That notable market smash variant sector.
Yes, yeah. And...
For those who aren't aware, chess variants come out from time to time. They usually die without a murmur. Mm-hmm. They just disappear. It is not a popular sector.
And nobody in their right mind should have ever formed a company simply for the majority owner's own game, especially if it's a chess variant. But the first convention we went to was Dragon Meet in Atlanta. I think this
Dragon
was
Con.
Dragon Con. Yes, Dragon Meet is in London, of course, just the past, which is why it was on my mind. Dragon Con. And we took Bosworth and we were, you know, doing okay. It was a fine little game for what it was. And, however, a fellow by the name of Matt Kirby came up to our booth and said that he had this game called Apples and Oranges, and he wanted us to try this. Mark, the majority owner, and I, the two gamers in the company, were like, oh God, gamer with a game idea. No, run, hide, anything. Al Waller, the salesman of the company, actually arranged to meet with Matt Kirby after the show at the Big Bar on 2. And Matt had this huge, giant game with lots of bells and whistles, and it was sprawling. It was fun. It was enjoyable, but it was very complex with many different mechanics. And this one small part of the game was where you got green cards, green apple cards, and the red orange cards, I believe, or orange cards. And one person played the judge, played a card. The other players threw down their cards, you know, blind, so nobody could see, and the judge chose their favorite. And Mark, at that moment, said, "Wait a second, this is the game." And I remember physically moving this giant game board to another table entirely. And for the next hour and a half, 2 hours, we were just all playing with this very basic prototype of what would become Apples to Apples. And we were blown away by it because there was nothing, none of us, and especially Mark nor myself, the two gamers, had ever seen any gaming mechanic like this at all. It was just spectacular.
It's a derivative of the Dictionary game, which is an old folk game and has been replicated many times. But it puts a really interesting twist on it. The Dictionary game is about trying to identify which one is the fake.
Right.
And all the players are involved. Apples to Apples takes the same structure and says, no, the judge decides their favorite. And that's... It doesn't sound... I mean, as with so many things, a minor mechanical tweak makes a massive, massive difference to the way that the game actually works. And yeah, I agree. Playing it for the first time back in, I think, 98, it didn't feel like anything else.
I mean, I'd played the Dictionary game as a kid in England, and then that was released commercially as Balderdash, if I remember correctly, as many folk games are. Somebody will just slap a label on it. But no, I've never really considered that at all, in fact. It was just this brand new engine to us. And in fact, I think Apples to Apples' success owes a pretty has a pretty direct link to the CCG industry, because when we were developing the game, the other members of the company of Out of the Box Games Publishing wanted just to use the simplest cards possible, so that anybody could play it. Anybody would know what the card was. And I said, wait a second, folks. I play these collectible card games, this game called Magic, and it's got flavor text on every card. So you can just put a description of the noun on the card, and anybody can play any card. You know, somebody may not know who Elizabeth Barrett Browning is, but you put a tiny little, you know, two sentences of a bio at the bottom, and people can play the card.
I had no idea that Magic had an impact on Apples to Apples.
Yes, that's absolutely. Cool. That's interesting. And I think by allowing Apples to put anything, any noun on a card, is what opened it up to everybody. So we could put hundreds of cards into the game, and not, you know, maybe 100 very common, very boring green cards. Those are the red cards. I beg your pardon. I'm actually looking over here at a pile of Apples to Apples cards, trying to remember which was which. But yes, and so the rest of the company basically said, okay, smart Alec, write it all. And for weeks, I would be on the couch with my laptop typing in a spreadsheet, yelling to my wife, Judith, honey, what's funny about mud? Type, 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 type. Judith, what's funny about the Kennedy assassination? And so I get quite a bit of good-natured flack from my friends in the industry who say, oh yeah, apples to apples, you drew the apple, you drew the logo. It's like, listen, I bled for that game, man.
Nice.
I bled. I put in my sweat equity is fully formed and functional in that.
Well, yeah, I mean, if it's any comfort, we don't remember who the other guys were, but we remember you did it. Yeah.
and the apple was part of it, even after, because I think Out of the Box had it for about 8 years, and then you sold it to Mattel.
Yes.
For some extraordinary, not as extraordinary as the number that we'll come to in a few minutes when we talk about Peter selling Wizards to Hasbro, but still, considering it's a board game, what you sell as...
It was a pretty extraordinary number. Hasbro bought Apples to Apples and a couple of other games.
Hasbro or Mattel?
Mattel, I beg your pardon. Thank you. Mattel. It was just all this Wizards of the Coast talk, which... you know, I'm a cartoonist because I get to go back and correct things. Don't have to be, you know, correct at the moment.
Yes, I seem to have become a games historian by accident.
But yeah, so we had developed Out of the Box up to the point where we were doing 25 million in sales a year.
Wow.
And the majority owner simply wanted it out. He was tired of us. He was tired of publishing. And when you're doing those kind of numbers, you cannot just reach into petty cash and buy the majority shareholder out. So we had to sell the company, and the other three of us owners, the co-owners, did not want to sell, but we really had no choice. And Mattel, pulled up the money truck, and even as by far and away the minority owner, percentage-wise of the company, it did, give financial security to my family. So I can never be that upset about it. But it would have been nice to, like, another 4 or 5 years along the ride would have been great, because I knew it was on the verge of becoming a pop cultural phenomenon. And it changed the games that you buy in America, anyway, in the big box stores. Up to that point, most of the games you would get in places like Target or Kmart or wherever were either trivia games, variation on trivia games, or these terrible licensed board games based on sitcoms or such. And once we got apples to apples into Target and into Barnes and Nobles, the whole scene just seemed to open up. And now you walk into a main street store, a high street store in the UK, or a big box store in the US or Canada, and there will be dozens of just really great board games available just sitting there for anybody to buy.
That's so cool. I mean, you know, it is so delightful. I still get giddy, you know, going into, I noticed it in Bartels, which I don't know if you have those there. It's a drugstore, you know, here. Just across the street, went there to get some medications, you know, and I just happened to go by the gaming section. It's like, oh my gosh. Yeah, there's a whole bunch of games here that are by, you know, our people. You know, that's good.
I mean, in the early 90s, you still had to work to find games.
Yeah.
You had to go to the big conventions. You had to find the friendly local game stores. I mean, it wasn't as bad as it was in the 70s or 80s. You know, things were getting better. There were more game stores around.
Yeah, there were actually game stores. You know, 70s and 80s, you had to go to the model railroading store, or
yes, a good chunk of my Avalon Hill collection actually came from KB Hobbies in the malls.
Yeah.
However, I will say the store I discovered role playing games in when I was at university in London back in the late 70s. Actually, no, I was still in high school. And I got my friends, my mom and my dad. We lived in Bristol, near Bristol in Somerset in the UK. I was going to school there. As you can tell from my accent, I was in fact born in Manchester. and I had lived about half my life in the UK up till I was about 20. But I would get, you know, I found this ad for a new game store, an actual dedicated game store in London. And London was about a 3-hour drive from us, but we would go do these day trips to London. And there's this tiny place in Hammersmith called Games Workshop that I got my parents to drive me to. And it was magic walking into that store for the first time. And there were games, there were miniatures, there was role-playing, and you didn't know it was role-playing, but I got this little white box labeled Dungeons & Dragons, and brilliantly, the folks at Games Workshop, either, you know, Steve Jackson or Ian Livingston, somebody had the bright idea of doing a little photocopied page, what is role-playing? And right next to this little white box, you had a little dungeon on one side of the page and a little dialogue from the players and the game master. And immediately, I would have been about 14, 15 at the time. And as soon as I picked this up, I knew what this was. And it just blew my mind. And I had to have this. It was the ultimate, it must be mine, Igor, Dork Tower moment. I just literally, mind went kablooey. It's like, and I was playing it the next week back in school with a couple of my best friends.
That magic of walking into a game store for the first time, I don't think, I mean, yes, games are much easier to find that. But I don't think that moment ever goes away. Because, and I can say this because last weekend was Dragon Meet in London, a one-day gaming show.
Not Atlanta? Was...
I took my 12-year-old. And yeah, she's been into a couple of game stores before and been to Forbidden Planet. But walking into Dragon Meet, you could just see part of her mind kind of reforming into, oh my God, there are people. There are so many people who do this, and there's so much. And then because it's 2022, she went, and there are dice, and proceeded to spend all her money on dice. The quality of dice is amazing these days, but that's probably an entirely separate podcast. But this whole thing, because Apples to Apples was amazingly influential. A lot of people picked up the mechanic and ran with it. And Cards Against Humanity is probably, again, an entirely separate discussion. But and Peter, you'd seen exactly the same thing with collectible card games, creating this gold rush of people desperate to cash in, some really interesting games, some absolute crap. But then... And I'm fast-forwarding through a lot of history here. TSR, the publisher of Dungeons & Dragons, had fallen on hard times. You stepped in. You bought the entire company with Wizards, you know. You took an afternoon off from doing the Scrooge McDuck diving into a pile of money thing to use some of that to buy TSR. Then you published Dungeons & Dragons 3rd Edition, which you were also co-designer on, and which is... For my money, I still think it's the best.
Oh, thank you.
And I'm not just saying that because you're in the room. I think it's as a single piece of work, it's a glorious addition. But then you did what people had done to you with Magic the Gathering. You essentially said, come and use this game engine. You open sourced it. You said anyone can publish material for Dungeons & Dragons 3rd Edition using not just the rules, but you know some of the monsters. And stuff. It's known as the Open Gaming License, and this created a smaller gold rush. But if I had to put my finger as a self-proclaimed game historian, if I had to put my finger on a moment that has brought Dungeons & Dragons to where it is now in terms of public perception, public awareness, and the whole streaming culture, the whole actual play culture. It's that. It was the moment that you basically said Dungeons & Dragons is for everyone.
Well, thank you. I want to rush in and give Ryan Dancy, you know, the credit here for coming up with the idea. His team, he might turn around and be thanking people like Keith Strom and Cindy Rice. But
you were the CEO.
Sure. That means I get to play Magic credit.
You said, you were the one who pressed the button.
That's fair. Yeah, it was this idea that people could come and make role-playing games using the system and some of the intellectual property that Wizards owned, but within some guidelines. It did, like Magic, it did create this big bubble, which of course always has a downside on the other side of it, but I accept your judgment, your proclamation that D&D's success now may have been rooted in that. And I think you might be right. I think that it really made Dungeons & Dragons a de facto standard, if you will. Like, this is a standard for role-playing games. And so a lot of game companies, you know, rallied around that while also taking it in new directions and making D&D bigger than it could be just from WotC's efforts. So, you know, you had, you know, games like, you know, D20 Modern and you know, some great games that happened out there using the D&D system to go in new directions. And it really did solidify D&D as a forerunner in the RPG category, you know, and until this day.
Yeah, it's where it is these days, and we're speaking with what looks like it's going to be a blockbuster movie coming out in just
so,
a few months.
Hey, can I bring up a new topic that is like because we're talking about I was in preparing for this time with you two, who I love both of you so much. It's really exciting to be here with you guys. Hanging out.
We love you too, Peter.
I mean, yeah. So in preparing for this, thinking about the era of the mid-90s to the mid-aughts, I think of this era as an era where a lot of us were questioning the validity of tabletop games and the longevity of tabletop games, because this is the era during which video games got so freaking good. I mean, so from video games, of course, were already getting good in the early 90s, and then you had MMOs come out, you know, in the, when did EverQuest come out? Probably around 2000, I'm guessing, something like that.
Earlier
than that, because at WotC, we were working on our own MMO before I sold the company. So, or by the time I left.
Oh, interesting, because Games Workshop was as well.
Yeah, by the time I left the company. Yeah, in the year 2000, we probably invested $10 or $15 million in developing an MMO around Dungeons & Dragons. And in fact, it was the moment when Hasbro made me cancel that project was when I decided, okay, you don't need me then. You know, and no, I'm not bitter. I'm just saying that's when it was. So, but we lived in this era where we were wondering, like, are people still going to want to get around a table and play games when video games are getting so good, and LAN games and internet games? And we told ourselves that, oh, yes, people want that human interaction. People want to be around a table facing each other with the focus of the conversation being each other and the shared space between us. Yeah, that's what we told ourselves. But let's be honest, we were wondering if it was really true, right? And that, I think, is an interesting bit of the psychology of what it was like to be in tabletop games during the late 90s and early aughts. And thankfully, our fears were unfounded at tabletop gaming. You know, video games, yes, blew up and became super huge and are here to stay, and they're way bigger than we are. But the tabletop game category got stronger during this period as well. And even though we're an order of magnitude or more smaller than video games, we've gotten big enough that we're a real category with lots of legs and feet and trajectory. And I think that's really cool.
You see, my first love in gaming was historical miniatures. Growing up in UK, you had, you know, Airfix, Desert Rats, and the Africa Corps, and just playing, you know, going from essentially playing with plastic soldiers to finding out that there were rules you could buy at the time in high street stores, you know, and that there would be a miniature gaming convention every weekend, just simply in a different city around Britain, it seemed. And you'd have to take the train or go to the local, you know, some parish where all of these the tiny little producers had their table, not even a booth, just a table set up with their lead minis.
Yes.
But I guess I never, as much as I enjoyed video gaming, to me the best video games were the ones where you're playing on a local network with like half of the Halo players upstairs and the other half downstairs, so you could, you know, yell and curse each other still in real time. And video gaming, again, I adore it. I will, you know, my kid and I have played through many, many games, but it's still, there's this very tactile satisfaction of sitting around a gaming table and holding onto those dice and rolling them, or picking up a miniature and moving it on a board or on a piece of felt, which is meant to represent Normandy or you know, kind of, or some such. And, you know, not having been the head of a multi-million dollar company, I never had to worry about such things. To me, it always seemed obvious that this is a very different sense of satisfaction you get just being with friends, having some drinks, doing some trash talking.
I mean, of course, I agree with you. I mean, that, of course, I agree that I felt the same way. But, you know, as running a business, you also had to think of, but you also have to think about how much of that is a generational feeling and how much of that really will translate to the next generation, the generation thereafter, and the generation thereafter, right? So it's like people that are playing D&D now, yes, some of them are enjoying miniatures on a felt table, but a lot of them aren't even using miniatures. A lot of people, they're not doing dungeon crawls. They're on Twitch and they're playing live, and it's more about being funny and acting than it is about, you know, like, oh, I'm one hex short of being able to get in to threaten that square so that there's an opportunity attack on the room, whatever, right? I mean,
it's interesting because, you know, during the pandemic, there was this giant surge in Twitch gaming, Zoom gaming,
right?
People following along, it seemed. And, you know, God bless 5th edition, which made the game so accessible to folks who had never gamed before, never role-played before. As much as I love 1st and 3rd editions, 5th just opened it up to everyone.
It is, by the way, that's funny. It is the odd. People ask me what edition I like. I say, oh, I like all the odd-numbered editions. Those are the best editions.
It's like the Star Trek movies.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think there are people who may have never experienced, you know, the game just by sitting around a table and somebody bringing the pizza or somebody bringing the drinks or something like that. But, you know, I just broke out during the pandemic. I broke out some 15 millimeter miniatures, to do a little game of Flames of War, a World War II.
Sure. Yeah.
Really lovely, fun little game. And my child, who was 11 at the time, was really interested in play, or 12, really interested in playing this, but they didn't want to play Nazis or Soviets. So we're just using the exact same miniatures. We had the Cat Kingdom versus the Dog Republic. And it was a hugely enjoyable time. And yeah, they just discovered this, you know, thrill of just picking up something heavy and moving it and rolling the dice. But, you know, there's so many different ways you can enjoy gaming.
Yeah.
And, the appeal, like in historical gaming, there's the research and there's the painting. If you're just going online on Twitch, you know, one of my groups did not want to use the maps which were available on the Roll20 app. They preferred the Theater of the Mind role-playing, where you just describe something and they would envisage it. So the maps were only used in a very, you know, general, okay, you guys are roughly around here sense, and just to refresh your memories. I mean, there's so many different angles you can come at gaming, tabletop gaming, or, you know, Zoom role-playing or whatever. And there's so many different ways, and you know, it's just like, yeah, there is no one way of experiencing or enjoying any of this. No, it's just, it's become so varied and massive, and there's so much out there. Like, you've got to go to a giant game store to get a little bit of everything anymore, whereas back in the 90s, a small store could pretty much carry everything that was being released been released.
And to take this back to our decade of interest, I think that what you're describing as the world now has its roots in the decade we're talking about, right? Like,
yes.
So you talk about anybody who is a cutting edge game designer recently, they grew up playing 3E, you know, or Games Workshop, and they grew up, that was their childhood, right? And our childhood was the 80s, right? And so it was an influential decade from the perspective of really stimulating. Things were just starting to diverge in so many different directions. James, you're trying to get a word in here.
Well, the other thing we've not talked about is what was happening in Germany, which, of course, is the focus of my book, Everybody Wins.
There's a book.
Because we're talking about 1995 to 2005, roughly. 1995 was Settlers of Catan.
Yeah.
This was the decade that was the golden age of German tabletop game design. This was we'd gone through the rapid development of the 80s, the Klaus Teuber, Wolfgang Kramer stuff. So Kramer's really, I mean, hitting his stride. He's coming out with stuff like Tikal and Torres and El Grande. We've got Carcassonne. We've got Ticket to Ride. It's just an extraordinary age for extraordinary games coming through, first of all, in Germany, and then the distributors, newly flush with collectible card game money, can afford to invest in this stuff, can afford to try it out.
If I could just jump in, there is like one more piece to the puzzle, which I believe is valid. In the 90s, you started getting newspaper coverage of gaming a lot more than you ever had before, more so than the very superficial stories. Like, you would be several newspapers ran articles every Christmas, what games to buy for Christmas. And that was a little bit, you know, talking about the game designers who had come up. These would be the reporters who had played these first generations of games as kids in the 80s or the late 70s, who were now in a position to scream about these, how good these were in major media outlets.
Right.
But anyway, I'm sorry, I interrupted you, James.
No, I was just saying there was a qualitative leap in how good the games were. The games were getting better themselves. They were noticeably better. And I think designers picked up on that really quickly, because also there was the internet, so we could communicate with each other about what was worth seeing, what wasn't. Board Game Geek was set up at the start of the new millennium. And that, you know, it started slow, but very quickly became the information resource and the gathering point for anyone who was interested really in any aspect.
Well, and you had the same thing happening in role-playing games at the Forge. Mm. You know, you had a huge revolution of game. You're talking about improving our ability as an industry to design games. It was happening in RPGs as well.
It was an extraordinarily fertile time. But the other thing you talked about, Peter, after you had sold Wizards of the Coast to Hasbro, and let's mention the figure at this point. I believe $375 million?
It's $496. the reason there's multiple numbers out there for what the price was is because it got adjusted. There was a base price, and then there was an earnout where where WotC shareholders, prior shareholders to this from the sale, continued to earn revenue from sales of non-Magic trading card games, and so not Magic and D&D. So Magic and the basis of the way the deal was structured was that Magic and D&D were considered mature, stable brands, and you could use classic sort of analytical tools to project their NPVs, their net present values. But the games like Pokemon, we had no idea how big it was going to go, how long.
I believe the biggest card game, probably the biggest, certainly the biggest card game of all time. What is it, 43 billion cards sold now?
No idea now.
Something like that. The number's in the book.
Yeah, but it definitely passed up Magic in the 90s. I mean, within a year of us buying it. Not buying it. Oh my God, no, licensing it. And I don't know where it ranks nowadays. If Magic has caught up to Pokemon, I would know. If it has, it certainly hasn't leapfrogged past it on that sort of scale. So I would guess that Pokemon is the best-selling collectible card game of all time. So, but yeah, that was a very interesting time.
But you displayed your absolute faith in what the core thing of what makes tabletop games work, because you bought Gen Con back from Hasbro. Hasbro having decided they didn't want it because it had been owned by TSR, so it was part of the deal. And Gen Con, for those who don't know it, is the second largest tabletop convention in the world after Spiel in Essen.
I think we're larger now, by the way. Not that it matters.
No, I mean, they're both extraordinary comings together of the clans, basically. And again, I mentioned my daughter walking into her first Dragon Meet. But I remember my first Gen Con in 1989, and there was a sense of I'm home. I'm in the middle of a different country in the Midwest, and this is weird. But these are my tribes, and this is where we come to meet once a year. And it became, you know, I went back every year. It was not cheap flying over from the UK as, at the time, a struggling freelance writer. But it was unmissable because it was where everything happened and where everyone was. And just the sense and the tone of it, that this is where the industry, where things changed. And indeed, in 1993, changed in a huge way, as I described.
Yeah, I grew up loving Gen Con and always wanting to go, you know, and there was a period of my life for several years where I wished I could go to Gen Con and couldn't, but fantasized about it. And then there was a period of my life where I was going as an exhibitor while it was owned by TSR. And then And then, yeah, when we acquired TSR, you know, it was for Dungeons and Dragons. But for me, it was always like the icing on that cake was this beautiful piece of candy called Gen Con. And we're like, so, yeah, it was, I had the opportunity to acquire it. I knew when I left, after selling the company to Hasbro, and when I was on my way out the door, I told the guy who succeeded me, I said, at some point, Hasbro's going to realize there are pieces of this business they don't want because they were on strategy for me, but they're off strategy for Hasbro. And when that happens, I'd appreciate a courtesy call because I might be interested in buying something that they don't want. And not really sure what that was. And sure enough, it was about a year later that I got the call and said, hey, are you interested in the magazines? No. Are you interested in our online store? No. Are you interested in all the Wizards of the Coast retail stores? No. Are you interested in Gen Con? For how much? Depends on the price. So, yeah. So
dare we ask? Dare we ask what the price was? Or is that?
Yeah, I don't mind letting you know. Yeah, it was about $1 million. It was, you know.
For a what at the time?
For Gen Con.
I'm trying to think. 40,000 people. Oh, convention? Not that seems
20.
Oh, okay, not
20. 22,000, maybe. I think 22,000. I got to jump in and say there's two ways of measuring convention attendance. One is called turnstile. One is called uniques. And so it's about 22,000 unique attendees. And that is if somebody comes to the convention for 4 days, they only count as one person. And so, you know, I love Essenspiele, but you know they count. They
count turnstile.
They count turnstile. So anyway, so we but there was an adjustment that made it a little bit cheaper. But yeah, it was just shy of $1 million. Well, and I needed a job. I had been like, I hadn't worked in a year. It was about a year after I quit, after I left Hasbro, that this opportunity came around.
My memory of the time is an impression of you flying around the world, going to carnivals, rock
That's
climbing,
exactly
and playing.
That's exactly right. D&D. I was spending money. I was living like a rock star. You know, yes.
You 1% of you.
I was all. It was a great time. It was a fabulous time, and all those stories are true. And then some. It was a great time, but there was a part of my mind going, okay, Peter, you're not gonna have money for very long if you keep living like this, and it's not gonna be good for your health. It's not, you're just doing way too many vices. And I acquired Gen Con and went back to work. And it was good for me. It turned out to be a great financial decision too. I made more money in with my Gen Con business than with my WotC business. So
wow.
Well, John, you were talking about being a small shareholder with out of the box, and that's yes. What I was at WotC. I didn't know money when I started WotC. So all the money that we needed to build that company came from elsewhere, which means that by the time the company was sold, I was very diluted. Yeah, but that's okay. I'm no complaints. It all turned out great.
But no, it's fantastic. And it is. It's the heart of people coming together to play games face to face and often complete strangers. And it's 4 days. It's the best 4 days in gaming is your slogan, which
yes,
I think is
that's right. And
hard to dispute.
And I gotta thank John Zinzer for that. So when we made the deal to buy Gen Con, for me to buy Gen Con from Hasbro, it happened right at about the time of Gamma. And so, we finagled it so that I could, that it was announced at Gamma. So it was at Gamma.
Gamma, the Games Manufacturers Association, an annual trade show.
That's right. So at Gamma 2002, it's announced, and John Zinzer from AEG just walks up to me, shakes my hand, and says, "The best 4 days in gaming."
Wow. Like,
thank you, John. That's a gift. That's the tagline right there. There it is.
You never paid him for that.
No, of course not.
No, brilliant. The best form of business. This has just been an absolute delight. Thank you so much. I would do this for hours more, but this has been an absolute joy. Thank you both so much for your time.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having us.
Absolutely a pleasure. Thank you.
Very, very quickly, where can we find you or your stuff?
My stuff is, most of it is at dorktower, dorktower.com. And the strip is now updated 3 times a week, thanks to a very successful Patreon. And hopefully next year it might go to 4 times a week.
And Peter, presumably you don't, you're not doing physical product anymore.
You can, well, mostly what I do is I'm the executive producer for Gen Con TV, which is Gen Con's Twitch channel. So that's what I'm doing these days, is running a Twitch channel. And I run one of the shows on the channel I personally produce called Actoroki. We have another a bunch of other shows on the channel as well. So twitch.tv/GenConTV. That's where you can find me and a bunch of other amazing people.
Fantastic. Thank you both so much.
This is the Play to Win podcast from Aconyte Books with me, James Wallace. This first series of the podcast accompanies my new book, Everybody Wins, 4 decades of the greatest board games ever made, out now in the UK and coming to the US and Canada in spring 2023.
Huge gratitude to John and Peter for their time, expertise and good humour. I thoroughly enjoyed that. A few pickups. Obviously, we talked about an awful lot of games and an awful lot of people. The notable ones, Magic the Gathering, the first collectible card game created by Richard Garfield, came out from Wizards of the Coast in 1993, is still in print. His game Robo Rally came out the year later, 1994, paid for by the money raised by Magic the Gathering. It's a delightful game of programming robots to fulfill missions on a factory floor and watching them go wrong. Dungeons & Dragons, which we talked about at some length, was created by Gary Gygax and Dave Arneson, first published by TSR Hobbies in 1974, and is currently on its 5th and most successful edition, though a new one is in the works. It was the first role-playing game, a generic fantasy game when it came out, and has now largely gone on to define the flavour of a lot of modern fantasy. John's comic strip, Dork Tower, can be found online at his website. The latest collection he's published is The Tau of Igor, which is highly recommended. The next episode, episode 4, moves on to a slightly troubled time. The Golden Age drew to a close. The Spiel des Jahres winners continued to come year by year. But there lacked a clear theme, a sense of direction, a mix of titles. One name stands tall among them. Rainer Knizia, who I'm enormously proud to say joins me for episode 4, along with the novelist Tim Clare. I think you'll enjoy their commentary and discussion very much.